Our next case this morning is EEOC versus AutoZone, case number 12-1017. Mr. Bain.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Garrett Bame. I represent AutoZone in this matter. Before launching into my substantive arguments, I need to note a mistake made in the reply brief, specifically footnote 2 on page 11 of the reply brief is inaccurate, and I simply ask the court to disregard it. Moving to my first issue, that of issue preclusion. The Supreme Court in 2008 in Taylor v. Sturgill said, issue preclusion bars successive litigation of an issue, a fact or law, actually litigated and resolved in a valid court determination essential to the prior judgment, even if the issue recurs in the context of a different claim. So what do we have here? When this case began, the EEOC alleged discrimination between the time period of March and September 2003 and then discrimination in January of 2004 and retaliatory termination in 2004. As this court knows very well, there was a summary judgment decision as to the initial period between March and September of 2003 based upon the basis that Mr. Shepherd was unable or impaired in a major life function, major life activity, I'm sorry. The case then went to trial before the first jury, and that jury was asked or instructed on what an essential function of the job is.
What was the question the jury actually answered?
The question the jury actually answered, I have it verbatim, is in January 2004, was Mr. Shepherd qualified to perform his job? And they answered, no. In the jury instructions, they were instructed what qualified means. Mm-hmm. And qualified means under the ADA, John Shepherd was qualified for the part sales manager job if he had the skill, experience, education, and other requirements for the job, and either could do the job's essential functions without a reasonable accommodation or could do the job's essential functions if he was given reasonable accommodations.
Didn't you all, in essence, tell the jury they did not need to decide this? The closing argument from that first trial on that point said, could he perform the essential functions of his job as a parts sales manager in January 2004? It's pretty obvious. No, he couldn't. In January 2004, he couldn't even get himself ready to go to work, much less perform the job. Let's get serious. So the answer to that question is no. That's a pretty good argument, isn't it? The jury could decide that answer no without deciding at all whether mopping was an essential function of the job.
Well, the issue that was at the essential function or the performance of the essential function was mopping. In that case, in that trial and in this trial, it was whether or not he could perform
mopping. I just read you the issue as presented by counsel for AutoZone.
Mm-hmm.
And you said he couldn't even get himself ready to work at all in January of 2004 after the September 2003 injury.
Certainly that was a global argument that was made in that closing argument.
So that sounds like different issues.
Well, I think when you look at the trial as a whole and the testimony that was provided in the first trial as well as the testimony in the second trial, it was a very simple issue, whether or not he received an accommodation for mopping, which all the evidence in those both cases showed was an essential function,
Did the jury in the first trial get the September 15-03 letter from Mr. Smith to Mr. Shepherd? The one that says
I don't recollect whether or not the first jury received that letter. I'm sorry.
The one that says you shouldn't be mopping, you don't have to do this, we don't want you to do this?
After the September 13th accident, correct, that Mr. Smith issued?
Right.
Correct.
Do they over? Do these times overlap in the two trials?
Do the two times overlap?
Yeah, yes. The as I recall, the period, whether it was in March to September or something, is one time period. But I don't know where that ends. Is it?
I don't think the two time periods, to answer your question, Judge, I don't think the two time periods overlap. But what the salient question is, was what was Mr. Shepherd's condition throughout? His condition did not change. If you look at
there was an accident in the middle of September.
It was September 13th.
That looked like maybe a permanent injury.
He had a permanent injury prior to that time. He was injured again on September 13th, received services, and was given a letter from his physician that he was able to return back to work in January of 2004. AutoZone did not allow him to return back to work, and the first jury found that that was not improper.
Well, I guess what... Well, go ahead. I'm still confused about exactly what the period of time for each trial.
The first trial was associated with a discrimination claim in January of 2004 that he wasn't given an accommodation and he wasn't allowed to return to work. It also involved a retaliatory discharge claim. The second trial, after a remand from this court when it overturned the summary judgment decision, focused on the time period between March and September of 2003, in which the EEOC alleged that Mr. Shepherd should have been given a reasonable accommodation and was not.
But his physical condition was materially changed for the worse in September, which is why the time frames were bifurcated as they were, or at least in part why the time frames were bifurcated.
There is no doubt that he was injured on September 13th. I'm making no issue about that whatsoever. But if you look at the documentary evidence in the case as to what his physical condition was between March and September 2003 and then in January of 2004, that condition was the same. You look at the physical capability forms. I'm looking at document 27-5 in the record, and also they're both document 27-5. It's a physical capability form for April 9th of 2003 and a physical capability form for January 6th of 2004. They are virtually identical as to what he is able and not able to perform. The only differences are as to the amount of time he could remain sitting or standing at once was limited to 4 hours in April of 2003 and 3 hours in January of 2004. The amount of time he could remain standing for the day was 8 hours in April of 2003 and 6 hours in January of 2004. That doesn't have any impact whatsoever. It is not material to whether or not he could perform the essential function of the job, mopping. And it's AutoZone's position that because that essential function of the job, the jury found that he was not capable of performing that in the first trial, that the EEOC and the government should have been precluded.
The theory seems to be, Mr. Boehm, that he could not perform the essential functions of the job for 6 months while he was on the job. Is that right?
That's correct.
It seems a little odd.
Well,
was it charity to keep him on the job at that time?
I don't think it was charity, Your Honor, but I'm just saying what he was capable of performing, according to his physician, his expert at trial, and his physician and his expert said he should not be mopping. He's not capable of mopping. He should not be doing that. He should receive an accommodation. He did not. But the issue is whether or not he was capable of performing it, and his physician said no. And the jury found in the first trial, no, he was not capable of performing that.
It said in January of 2004 that, as AutoZone's counsel argued, he couldn't even get himself ready to go to work in January of 2004, right?
That's what was argued.
I assume that was a fair comment on the evidence, right?
It was a fair comment.
Okay. So the jury didn't have to decide the mopping issue.
According to the instructions, I would say the jury had to, and how the instructions were given, and what a qualified meant including this, performing the essential functions of the job, and it said that he could not. The jury
did the instructions specify mopping, that they had to decide that issue?
No, they specified the essential functions of the job, and mopping was one of them. Should this court determine that issue preclusion does not carry the day, the next issue I'd like to address is the good faith defense to punitive damages in this case. AutoZone did have an anti-discrimination policy in place. It performed the necessary education and training with regard to that anti-discrimination policy. And then there was also the aspect of enforcement. And that testimony, that evidence of enforcement, is found in Teresa James's testimony at the end of the second trial. And she provides information that when a written accommodation request was submitted to AutoZone, it was essentially roundtabled by HR, benefits, and legal. She said that during her tenure at AutoZone, which included 2003 forward, that policy, that protocol had been followed. So there was enforcement of that anti-discrimination policy. That group of people would get together, determine whether or not a reasonable accommodation could be given or should be given, and then would act accordingly.
Was her testimony that that's what they did with Mr. Shepard?
It does not appear to be what happened with Mr. Shepard. And trying to read between the lines as to why that did not occur is that he did not submit a written accommodation request. What he submitted were these physical capability forms. Now, that said, there were discussions with benefits, specifically Mr. Smith, who was the district manager, had discussions with Jackie Moore. And actually, in the record, if you look at page 192, Mr. Shepard discusses that he had a telephone conference with a Tracy Burham, an individual named Chris. Neither of those two individuals testified at trial, and Jackie Moore. And the result of that conversation was that Jackie Moore was going to speak with Mr. Smith, the district manager, about providing a reasonable accommodation. So it shows that if Jackie Moore is construed as upper management, which I don't think she was, that there were actions being taken, that his situation was not being ignored, but was being acted upon.
Is that something to do with that letter that came from Smith in September?
I don't know. That letter was after the conversation that Shepard had with Ms. Moore, Ms. Burham, and Chris.
Would that be a response, though, where he said, what did he say he didn't have to mop?
He said that he should not have, that he was not supposed to be performing mopping, that he had certain limitations and he should be following.
Well, was that a response from the whatever came from up above?
I don't know. That's not in the record. It was a letter that was issued by Mr. Smith 2 days after the accident. I don't know that was in response to something that happened above.
Well, I'm only looking at the standpoint of punitive damages.
Mm-hmm.
Did they address a situation and Smith responded to it, basically acknowledging an accommodation, even though maybe he never took advantage of it. But I'm just wondering, I'm looking at punitive damages from that standpoint. And from your point of view, what's the standard of proving punitive damages?
Well, they have to show that there was malice and reckless indifference to Shepard's federal rights.
Yeah, more beyond just the negligence or whatever they want to
talk about.
Correct,
beyond negligence. And I would say at most...
For the compensatory, you got $100,000.
Correct.
You got $200,000 for the punitive.
After it was reduced.
Because of the statute. So I'm just wondering what... I guess you're making an argument that they didn't meet the standard.
That the good faith defense should control and that punitive damages should not have been entered against AutoZone.
I'm then just asking as part of the evidence of good faith that they did, in fact, address it, and Smith so said in his letter. I'm not getting that you don't seem to be attaching that letter to a good faith response. Or maybe you are. I don't know.
Well, I was really focusing on whether or not the contention by EEOC is that upper management was basically ignoring Mr. Shepard altogether.
And you don't, I don't know whether that was upper management that he talked to, but for some reason Smith wrote the letter, and I'm just wondering if that's the response.
Well, that was a response after the accident occurred. The conversation involving Shepard and Ms. Moore seems to have occurred sometime in June. And then Ms. Moore said she was going to, according to Shepherd, was going to speak to Mr. Smith about getting an accommodation, so they didn't get him out. So that is really what I was focusing on, to show that if Moore is considered upper management, that she actually was taking actions in Mr. Shepherd's, or agreeing to take actions in Mr. Shepherd's behalf.
Could the jury consider whether the entire defense was honest in deciding whether to award punitive damages in this case?
Is that going to EEOC's contention that someone was lying?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I think that that may have been focused towards Mr. Smith's testimony, and EEOC does not make a contention that Mr. Smith was upper management. So I think that needs to be divorced from the question.
Well, the way that argument would go is that the entire defense was based on lies. And we have case law saying that that's appropriate, an appropriate circumstance for punitive damages.
Again, I would say that if there is any validity to the notion that there were lies, those lies would have been issued by Mr. Smith, and he was not upper management. And the good faith defense focuses upon the acts of upper management, having knowledge of the situation, failing to act, or recklessly disregarding it. And I don't think there's evidence of that in the record. My last point has to do with the injunction.
Your time has expired.
I'm sorry. Well, I guess I won't get to injunction. Thank you.
Mr. Harrington.
It pleases the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Eric Harrington. I'm here on behalf of the United States Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Let me begin by making a factual clarification. Counsel just represented to the court that the first jury was instructed that the essential functions of the job included mopping. That is not true. That is the punitive damages instructions on record 134. And whether mopping was an essential function was a disputed fact in both cases. So let me just break down why their issue preclusion argument is incorrect. The first jury concluded that Mr. Shepherd was not qualified to perform the essential functions of the job from January 2004 on. The second jury concluded that he was qualified to perform the essential functions between March to September 2003. There is a big difference between those two dates. As the court pointed out, on September 12, 2003, Mr. Shepherd was injured in a mopping accident, and he has not worked since. AutoZone told the jury, there's even more than Judge Hamilton pointed out. This is exactly the quote, and this is on record 139, page 77. This is what AutoZone argued to the first jury. Quote, this case starts on January 16, 2004, the day Dr. Katchen released Mr. Shepherd to return to work. So all this stuff about his ability to accommodate himself in 2002 and 2003, terrific. They go on to argue that Mr. Shepherd could do nothing. He couldn't dress himself. They mocked his disability. They said, there's only one job I know of in the world where you don't have to move, and that's being a guard at Buckingham Palace. So their argument on the January 2004 ADA claim was, he can do nothing. He can't work. Their argument on the March to September 2003 accommodation claim was that he's lying. That was their argument on the second trial, that we were, in fact, accommodating him. Now, embedded in that, there was a dispute about whether mopping was an essential function. And that would be precluded in the second trial only if it was essential to the first jury's judgment.
Well, they were requiring mopping during that for the second trial. They were, and that's how he was when we got injured on the 12th, I guess, of September, right?
Right. So the issue of the second trial, so the question of whether mopping was an essential function, the jury decided it wasn't, and there was lots of evidence as to why. So by the way, they're not disputing that there was sufficient evidence to reject their argument that mopping was an essential function. So the first jury did not have to decide that mopping was an essential function. In fact, they did not. There's no special question on it, and AutoZone even said you don't have to answer this question. Instead, this court should see should identify what this tactic really is about. I stood in this courtroom 2 years ago, and the other counsel for AutoZone stood up, and it's been a long time for Your Honors, but this was the panel, and he stood up, and his very first words out of his mouth was, this case involves a very finite period of time. You go listen to the transcript. It involves March to September 2003. And Mr. Shepherd's disabilities after that have nothing to do with this case. Now they come and they say, It's all the same. There's a big difference between these dates, and the first jury's verdict does not preclude the second's. They sat on this defense and allowed pretrial motions, this case, to hear argument on this claim, issue an opinion for months. So I think even just as a prudential matter, this court should reject it just because they waived it and sat on it for so long. And if the court has any questions about the issue of preclusion, I'll move to punitive damages.
Well, I guess I'm trying to separate them just because I was looking at the punitive damages. And looking at it from somebody who doesn't know how to run an AutoZone shop, it would seem that anybody can mop. He apparently had really good reports for doing whatever you do behind the counter and getting people fixed up with the right stuff they want to buy and all that sort of thing, putting in batteries, I suppose, you know, things that otherwise, other than mopping. Was there some, did when you said the jury determined that mopping was not an essential, are they taking it, assuming that he could do all the other stuff, therefore he was qualified and, right. And shouldn't have had to mop?
So to be clear, so the second jury concluded that he was qualified. Our entire claim was based on the notion that Mr. Shepard required an accommodation from mopping. If mopping was an essential function, he would not be qualified. And that was always our position. If mopping was an essential function, he couldn't mop. So therefore, under the ADA, he would not be qualified, because in order to be qualified under the ADA, you have to have the ability to perform the essential functions. With an accommodation sometimes, some help, but you still have to be able to perform the essential functions. So mopping was not an essential function. And let me just give you the facts, the evidence.
Mopping was not?
Was said. Not. Yeah. Mr. Wilmot was a store manager who encouraged Mr. Shepard to transfer to his store because Mr. Shepard was so good at sales. And Mr. Wilmot said, oh, mopping's nothing. I don't even need to do that. I need to do the important stuff, the essential stuff, selling parts. AutoZone denied that they didn't accommodate him. So if it wasn't, as you point out Mr. Smith's letter, post-accident cover-up letter, he's saying you don't have to mop. So their position is inconsistent. But it doesn't really matter, because that issue of whether mopping is an essential function, as a matter of law, is not before this court. They're not challenging the sufficiency of the evidence in that regard. They're only saying that the first jury decided that, and it did not. The second jury was free to address that question.
Well, I'm looking at also the distinction between the compensatory and punitive.
Let me just get to the punitive. I think the punitives are actually quite easy. We have to show a reckless disregard for Mr. Shepard's federal rights, and you can do that under this court's doctrines two ways. One, that the people who violated his rights knew about their obligations under the law. AutoZone stipulated that all of these folks had ADA training. Mr. Smith, Mr. Thompson, Tracy Burham, all the people higher up in the organization. That is enough to sustain the punitive damage award. The second way to show that they acted in reckless disregard is if they lied or covered up about it after the fact. And again, AutoZone's own counsel said that this was a he said case. This case, according to AutoZone, turned completely on whether, and this is their transcript 9798. This is the classic she said case. Mr. Smith and Mr. Thompson denied they ever forced Mr. Shepard to mop. We know that Mr. Shepard, Mr. Smith, and Mr. Thompson can't all be right. Somebody is not telling the truth. And AutoZone said Smith and Thompson are telling the truth, and Wilmot and Shepard are lying. The jury believed Wilmot and Shepard. So the evidence shows that the officials who violated his rights were lying about it. And that letter, the cover-up letter, I think is a great piece of evidence demonstrating that they were doing just that. They knew that they were violating his rights, and they covered it up. They're trying to cover it up after the fact. And then they lied to the jury about it. And then they spent 8 years covering it up.
You know, his rights by making him mop, is it?
Yeah, and saying that we didn't force him to mop after all. Mm-hmm. So they got caught, they knew they were outside the law, and then they tried to cover it up, and the evidence supports that finding. Now AutoZone argues that it's entitled to judgment as a matter of law on its good faith defense. And again, you have to take all the facts in light most favorable to the EEOC here. And you can reject the good faith defense if there are senior officials who are aware of it. They just have to be aware of it and do nothing. And here we have several layers of senior officials who were aware of it and did nothing. The head of the lead disability coordinator, Jackie Moore, did nothing. The vice president of stores, Craig Blackwell. Mr. Shepard was pleading with these officials for months. I can do everything but mop. Just give me a break. and they ignored him. So that's not a good faith effort to enforce the Americans with Disabilities Act if they're ignoring him. So the good faith defense can be rejected, and the jury could have rejected it that easily. And Alderson really, I mean, now they're disputing whether these are senior officials or not. I'm talking about the vice president of stores and the lead disability coordinator. These are the definition of senior officials. I think they only addressed issue preclusion and punitive damages. So I assume they won't be able to address the other issues in rebuttal, and therefore I will not, unless the court has questions about any of those other issues.
I have a question about the scope of the injunction, Mr. Harrington. There was a specific objection concerning the record-keeping requirements that are imposed under that injunction. Could you address why aren't those oppressive, unnecessary?
Your Honor is aware, this is a pretty modest injunction. It only covers the Central District of Illinois. We've demonstrated a practice of violating the ADA, and then...
Well, you've got one case.
Yeah, but we also have senior officials who are aware of it and did nothing. And this is all the injunction requires. Follow the law. When people come to you asking for accommodations, let us know for 3 years. 1 year of that is already almost over. It was in November. And for 4 years, keep records when they come and ask you, just so you're documenting all the people that just asked. Just keep records. Sally Smith asked for an accommodation. Keep that record.
What is the import of the follow the law part of the injunction? I mean, usually we can't have injunctions that say that.
But this is incredibly common in the employment discrimination case. And in fact, the Supreme Court says that district courts have an obligation to do this. And here's why. The entire employment discrimination regime, from the way the EEOC is supposed to conduct and conciliate, it's all about preventing and remedying discrimination, but mostly preventing. And here we have an employer that has engaged in discrimination of the kind that you would award punitive damages for. And if they do this again and ignore the next John Shepard in the Central District of Illinois, we can just bring an action, enforce this in the Central District of Illinois, get the discrimination remedied, and not have 9 years of litigation like we've had now in order to remedy one instance of ADA discrimination. So that's the purpose of why Congress has authorized these kind of injunctions in the employment discrimination context, and they're kind of commonplace when we prove discrimination. For example, the EEOC, we really won't even settle a case with that kind of an injunction. And this is honestly quite modest compared to what most of these look like. Does the court have any other questions?
Apparently not.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Boehm, your time has expired, but I'll give you a minute in rebuttal.
I will only use that minute. I would ask the court to look to pages 192 to 195 of the transcript to determine whether or not senior officials at AutoZone were in fact ignoring Mr. Shepard, as the EEOC now contests. Specifically on page 192, talking about that conversation again, Mr. Shepard says, "I had a meeting with Tracy, Chris, and Jackie on a conference call, and that they were supposedly to get with Stephen Smith to tell Stephen Smith to start pretty much helping me to adjust to the tasks, you know, and pretty much accommodate me." He's saying that's the message that he left for Mr. Blackwell, the vice president of the stores. So what was there for Mr. Blackwell to do? He thought that the situation had been resolved.
What was the date of that conversation?
We don't have a specific date, but sometime in June, I believe, of 2003. The message was left for Mr. Blackwell in early July of 2003. So I would just contend to the court that there is no basis to conclude that upper management was ignoring Mr. Shepard's needs.
Are you saying that Shepard's testimony indicated he called Blackwell to say everything's taken care of?
It's right in the record to say that I'd spoken with three individuals, Tracy, Chris, and Jackie, and that Jackie was going to talk to Mr. Smith about an accommodation.
And was there anything further, like, and nothing had happened?
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.